action right now. Just call 713-526-5738 or give online at
KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community media, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
We have finally snuck around to that time. We are getting super close to general elections. Early voting starts on the 24th, which is this coming Monday, and will run through November 4th. And you can go to your elections clerk in Harris County at... I haven't said that name in so long. Now, what is the website there? Harrisvotes.com.
Yes.
And you can find your closest, most convenient voting location for early voting. Always recommend early voting. And remember, elections have consequences. So don't just listen to the polls. Actually get out there and vote in the only poll that actually matters.
Do we still have that list of county clerk and election websites on thinkwingradio.com?
It is eternal. We haven't checked its accuracy in the last few months, but we did update it a while back. So, yeah, if you want to find, we have the election clerk links for Harris, and I think every adjacent county to Harris where you might hear this show.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not sure how to reach your election clerk, you can go to thinkwingradio.com. It's a lengthy thing. Near the top of every blog post, because I am a nag about voting. it's there. And if you find a link that doesn't work, you can let me know by going to the Facebook page, Think Wing Radio, or you can let me know at Think Wing Radio on Twitter, or you can email me at thinkwingradio@msn.com. So lots of ways. Or if you don't want to tell me, maybe you don't like me, maybe my voice irritates you, you can always contact Andrew and he'll tell you how to do that later.
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at DominateAYE and on Tumblr spelled the same at DominateI.tumblr.com. I'd give you my Twitch, but I don't think I would see complaints about thinkwingradio.com.
Well, good boy, you never let a chance for self-promotion get by you. That's a good sign. Okay, just FYI, there are a lot of different sources currently available easily online for information about candidates and races. Community Impact News has been doing a series of these articles on various candidacies. Charles Kuffner's offthecuff.com, that's Cuff with a K. He does a heck of a job, man. He is, apparently, I read an article once, he's up really early in the morning every day doing his column. And it really is a heck of a piece of journalism and very entertaining. So offthecuff.com. I've also seen KHOU11.com and KPR, was it Click2Houston?
Click2News.
Click2Houston.com. I get them confused. It's all this and that.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I have a young person to keep me on my toes. But anyhow, there are lots of different local sources. And, you know, you may have your preferred source. You may have a political party that you want to go to for the general that may have endorsements. You may want to go to a specific interest group. Sometimes I go to AFL-CIO, or sometimes I go to thecaucus.org. I mean, you may have your own thing to get your own recommendations. And that's all I can really say because this is a 501c3. Okay.
And, well, I suggest if you're still undecided and you want to, you know, get more information to make up your mind, going to the various state parties, various state political parties websites and reading their platforms can help you get a more complete sense of what they believe in and what they put forward.
I said that a little bit in terms of going to the various party sites, but that's okay. That's a refinement of what I said. Also, the League of Women Texas.
Yes.
League of Women Voters for Texas.
Yes.
They have a site that is a good site in many ways. Also, Ballotpedia. So there's lots of information out there. I know ballots can be long, but it is possible to kind of sort through this stuff and come to some at least semi-educated decisions, as opposed, you know, especially in Texas when they took away straight ticket voting. So now you really have to kind of think about it. Okay. This is kind of a PSA from clickhouston.com. Stacking stones is not allowed in Texas. This is why rock cairns are prohibited at Lone Star State Parks, authorities say. And this is kind of interesting. I didn't know this, but it makes perfect sense. Cairns are the stacks of stones people place often in waterways or on trails. In Texas parks, they're not allowed. A social media post reads, "While we are impressed by your rock stacking abilities, the building of rock cairns is not allowed. Doing so disturbs sensitive and critical wildlife habitats that rely on the rocks for protection. This is even more serious during times of drought and low water levels like we're experiencing at the park now. Wildlife are already isolated to specific areas of the river and streams when water levels drop, and the building of rock cairns destroys what habitats are left. These results in those wildlife species moving somewhere else, causing a break in the ecosystem." Does that sentence make sense to you, or is that just me?
It was this results. So
this results. Oh, this. Let me read it again. This results in those wildlife species moving somewhere else, causing a break in the ecosystem. I was just putting the emphases and reading it wrong. Okay, it goes on. Wildlife such as aquatic macro invertebrates specifically rely on these rocks for survival and protection. When the rocks are moved, it destroys and disturbs their home. Imagine if someone did that to your house. Aquatic macro invertebrates help indicate overall water quality and are crucial to the freshwater ecosystems for other species such as fish. When their job and role in the environment becomes much harder during times of low water and drought, it becomes near impossible when rocks are removed to build rock cairns. I mean, imagine if someone tore down your house because they wanted to build a log cabin. That would really tick you off, I think. Help protect the river and stream ecosystems by leaving all the rocks alone, not building rock cairns, and enjoying your time in the park by following the leave no trace ethos. The article does go on to note that some parks in the United States do have cairns, but they serve a specific purpose, to help hikers and mark trails. As the National Park Service noted in its write-up on cairns, and there is a link, it advises visitors to check each park's guidelines before visiting. In Texas state parks, again, they are not allowed. So, I mean, think about it this way. If one person builds a cairn, that's not a big deal. But when you're talking a state park and you build a cairn, and then the next person builds a cairn, and the next person builds a cairn, and the next thing you know, there are a lot of cairns, and a lot of the rock cover that is used as habitat is suddenly gone. It's kind of like when you go to Greece and you visit the archaeological ruins of the ancient Greek civilization, you are not allowed to pick up and take so much as a pebble. And if they find a pebble in your luggage on the way out, you are in for a world of grief. Because when you have a million or so visitors in a time span, and if each visitor picks up a pebble, in a little while there won't be any pebbles. And the next thing you know, they're chipping away at the ruins. So this is kind of the same logic. If one person builds a cairn and the next does and the next does, it messes up the entire ecosystem. My personal feeling is that, yeah, I mean, building cairns just for fun, it's like people are just building it for the equivalent of saying Kilroy was here. And if you don't know what that means, it's age related. And I provided a link for the curious among you on the blog post for this story. I don't know that you have anything to add, Andrew.
Not particularly on this one. Just don't build a cairn. Leave the rocks alone.
And that's the summation of the story right there. Okay. From communityimpact.com, more reliable than ever, quote, Texas energy regulators share updates on grid redesign. Now, I'm going to suppress my grins and laughs as much as I can. According to state leaders, Texas's power grid is, quote, more reliable than ever, with additional improvements to come. Less than 2 weeks after stepping into his new role, Pablo Vegas, CEO of the Electric Council of Texas, Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, I won't laugh, provided updates on the grid conditions and his priorities as head of the agency on an October 13th news conference. Vegas was joined by Peter Lake, chair of the Public Utility Commission of Texas. Lake touted the power grid's ability to withstand severe weather conditions, including unusually high temperatures over the summer, because what else other kind of temperatures Texas have? The power demand reached record levels 11 times this summer, Lake said, but the grid did not enter emergency conditions. Despite recent successes, energy regulators have faced heavy criticism. Of course, success means it didn't break. That's a low bar. Anyway, they faced heavy criticism and distrust from customers following Winter Storm Uri, which hit the state in February 2021. Over two-thirds of Texans lost power during the storm, and nearly half lost access to running water, and I and many others resemble that remark. The key to rebuilding confidence in the electrical grid is going to be continued reliability, execution, and operations. That's our collective focus at ERCOT, Vegas said. Power plants and generators across the state have been weatherized for all seasons of the year, including, and I had to suppress a laugh, insulation, coverings, and heat tracing for pipes. They tell you to do that in your house, guys. You couldn't figure this out on your own? Anyway, statewide weatherization requirements were created by Senate Bill 3, which Governor Greg Abbott signed in June 2021. Abbott said at a 2021 news conference, the failure to weatherize can result in penalties of up to $1 million per day of noncompliance. Under the bill, a power outage alert system will notify Texans if the power supply becomes too low to meet state or regional command. That or your lights will go out. Lake said ERCOT's operational changes cost each household an additional $1.25 per month on average. Data was not readily available to support this statement, but Lake said it will be released publicly, kind of like Trump's tax returns. Energy regulators are in the first phase of a massive system overhaul. The first phase includes taking action earlier to prevent blackouts, increased efficiency standards, because doing more with less is always the way to go, and changes to the use of ancillary services. The PUCT aims to release the plans for phase two by mid-November, Lake said. Information about the grid redesign will also be presented to state lawmakers in January during the 88th Texas legislative session. Now, first of all, FYI, ERCOT's failure to be, quote, reliable traumatized me enough to buy a solar power system for my house. And so far, I've been very happy with that decision. Mm. I also think it's interesting that there are two obvious missing elements in this story. They don't talk about increasing access for wind power to connect mm-hmm. to the rest of the grid. And they don't really talk. Well, there was a second thing I was going to say.
Does it have anything to do with what I'm going to talk about?
it's possible. Well, okay. Anyway, yeah. Yeah, sorry about that. You see, we used to do more editing, and now it's just like, Mike is forgetful. But yeah, I got a solar power system, and you know what's weird is as we get later in the year and the sun gets lower in the sky, on an average day, I think I'm actually getting more power generated just because, coincidentally, the angle of my roof, I think, is more suitable to the position the sun has in the sky right now.
Okay.
So, you know, the cells don't move to accommodate the sun. They're just mounted flat on the roof. It's a south-facing roof, but, you know, when the sun is high in the sky, that's a more oblique angle than when the sun is lower in the sky. So I think I'm actually getting a little more power, even though the days are a little shorter. Anyway, Andrew, enough of my blathering on. What have you got to say?
Well, first off, something that occurred to me, I think in not the last paragraph, but the one before, increased efficiency standards. Now, you mentioned that was doing more with less. What I think that might actually be, because we're talking about power here.
Oh, the other thing was connecting the grid to the national grid.
Connecting the grid to the national grid, which, of course, they'll never do because
they'll never do.
The Texas state government is obsessed with keeping this ridiculous secessionist dream alive. Yeah. But I think increased efficiency standards here might actually be energy efficiency, which would not necessarily be a bad thing.
Energy efficiency, if that is what they're talking about, would not be a bad thing. It would also represent significant infrastructure investment, both at the plants and in carriage.
Yeah.
I have a feeling it's more like saving money by buying fewer pencils and making the pencils last longer, because that's sort of the accounting mentality.
And that's entirely possible. Like, that's entirely fair.
And,
but
and
I just thought
hours, less staff. You know how it goes.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, so ERCOT's plans sound great, but this is all about stopping the grid from going down. What about if, or rather when, it does go down again? Where's the protection from electricity price gouging for consumers? Where's the state support for community weather shelters if nobody has any heat or AC, depending on what the weather outside is like? Where are the improvements to water systems to keep them running in an outage? Weatherization of the grid is great, but it's only part of the necessary improvements around the state. This should have been a broader event, this press conference, that covered not just grid upgrades, but the entire state government's plan to stop Uri from happening again, and to stop it from being as bad if it does.
Well, now I'm going to add a couple of caveats.
Mm-hmm.
The story as presented is excerpted from a longer piece.
Yes, of course.
And we also don't know the way it's reported. Maybe that was mentioned but not covered, or maybe it's in a piece I left out. So just working with what we've got,
right?
You know, I'm still not convinced that this is more than just some PR boilerplate.
Exactly. I think that if the state government, if Abbott had been here, actually, does it say Abbott was here? I'm not sure it says.
I don't think it mentions his name. I just have to tell you, it flipped me out when they're talking about insulating the pipes.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Seriously, guys, you haven't figured this out yet. And you've been like in Texas, you claim in most cases for generations, and you haven't figured out that we freeze so infrequently that covering the pipes is a good idea because the house or the structure around the pipes will not insulate them. I mean, this is like, who the hell is running this ship anyway?
Yeah, exactly. But if this was a press event that Governor Abbott was at, for example, yeah, I really think my point stands. He should have taken to the podium and been like, okay, that's what ERCOT is doing. That's the grid improvements that are coming. Here's what else we are doing, because it wasn't just the problem with the grid. The core problem, the problem that started it all, was the grid. But everything after that was because of the state's terrible, terrible response. So
yeah,
there's a lot more work to do.
Yeah, I don't think either of us disagree with either of us.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah, we're just annoyed.
we're just annoyed at them. We are mutual. Again, the center left and the far left agree. We're all annoyed at the government of Texas. So you see, we can find a place on the Venn diagram. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. If you want to podcast it, so far, it looks like you need to use Google Podcasts. Now, you can find them at the Android store, or you can find it at the iPhone store. Google Podcasts will receive this show and presumably other KPFT shows, but I can't swear to that. Also, you can listen to older shows by going to archive.kpft.org. And of course, on my website, I have stuff going back to 2010. Every story on the show is typically heavily excerpted, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click on show posts and more at the top of the webpage. Find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can type keywords into the search bar. It's a little one, but it's there. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. Look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Our next story, I've actually got kind of a triplet from Texas Tribune that I thought went well together, and apparently they did too, because they were all published the same day. The first one is, 2/3 of board members overseeing Texas public universities are Abbott donors. They're not shy about wielding influence. High money donors are concentrated at larger boards, including those of the University of Texas system, rather, and Texas A&M University system. In 2017, State Rep Lyle Larson authored a bill to block any governor from appointing someone to a state board or commission who had contributed more than $2,500 a year to their campaign. Larson, a San Antonio Republican, said he'd heard concerning stories from a constituent who was interested in joining the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission, and later from a friend who was trying to join the Texas A&M Board of Regents. Both people, Larson told the Texas Tribune, felt deterred after hearing that the best way to land an appointment on a prestigious state board or commission was to give the governor a donation that would get them noticed, sometimes called pay to play, but not here. Larson's bill passed the House with bipartisan support that year, but it never got a hearing at the Senate. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who oversees the Senate, declined to advance the bill through the chamber, Larson said. Larson, who is not seeking re-election this year, and it seems like any Republicans that I might remotely agree with are not seeking re-election, which is sad. He's not seeking re-election this year and is backing Patrick's Democratic opponent in November. He, meaning Dan Patrick, said to Larson, no, that's how people raise large sums of money when they run for governor. Patrick did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Patrick did not put the measure up for a vote. Governor Greg Abbott is seeking a third term, is the most prolific fundraiser in modern state history. He has named donors to all sorts of boards and regulatory commissions across Texas, but they are especially concentrated on the boards running 36 public universities. The region set tuition rates and faculty salaries, approve new degree programs, audit university finances, manage campus growth plans, and hire and fire university presidents and football coaches. I can see the appeal of that. Abbott has appointed all 90 people who currently serve on 9 university system boards, plus the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board. During his nearly 8 years as governor, he's made 114 such appointments. A Texas Tribune analysis found that more than 70% of all these appointees have donated to Abbott's gubernatorial campaign, only 70%, including donations given in their spouse's or company's name, if they are the CEO. About 30% of the appointees have given more than $100,000. A Tribune analysis also found that the larger and more prestigious the university system, the more likely its board is to be stacked with deep-pocketed donors. This is a long story. It's one of those Texas Tribune deep dives. So, you know, I couldn't read the whole thing, and I certainly couldn't excerpt the whole thing, but it really is worth at least a deep skim. It's a much longer story, and I think it can be summed up in 3 words, which is graft and corruption. Now, I could have said 2 words and left out the end, but I want it to be accurate. The U.S. Civil Service, just FYI, was created in the late 19th century specifically to curb use of the spoils system, a term for repaying large political contributors with prestigious and sometimes profitable jobs. As explained in Wikipedia, certain senior civil service positions, including some heads of diplomatic missions and executive agencies, were filled by political appointees. Now, to my mind, that is exactly what this article describes. Elected executives such as governors are hypothetically within their rights to make senior appointments to enact their policies. But should those appointments be based on merit or money? How the system in Texas can or should be reformed is the devil in the details, but it obviously should be. I think Texans need a government willing to look at this power and curb it for a more merit-based appointment system. Remember, elections have consequences. Vote, Andrew.
Well, you know, it's a rare thing for me to endorse action from a Republican, but even Representative Larson's bill would be a welcome start towards reducing the power of money in politics. I also think eliminating a major funding method for governorships would go some way to leveling the playing field in Texas politics for third-party candidates. With appointments off the table, gubernatorial candidates would have slightly less appeal to rich donors, and that could result in slightly less money in the duopoly candidates' coffers. Not enough to close the funding gap by any means, but enough to make the race a little more competitive and thus a little more democratic.
You know, when you say level the playing field, they can fire coaches.
They can level up the playing field,
as the current saying goes. Okay, from, again, Texas Tribune, this is story 2 in the trilogy. In Texas, where money has long dominated politics, Greg Abbott is in a league of his own. Doesn't even look like Gina Davis. The two-term governor's donors enjoy access, appointments to boards and commissions, and a chance to bend the ear of a politician who may harbor bigger ambitions. Since Greg Abbott first declared he would run for governor on July 14, 2013, he's raised the equivalent of $83,793 per day to fund his pursuit of power. That's $20,000 more than the median Texas household earns in a year. Median Texas household usually is 4 people, by the way. Throughout his political career, Abbott has amassed a mountain of campaign cash unrivaled in Texas. He is easily the most prolific fundraiser in state history, even compared with his two predecessors, George W. Bush, who went on to become president, and Rick Perry, who served as a governor for a record-breaking 14 years. Since 1995, when Abbott made his first bid for statewide office for a seat on the Texas Supreme Court, he has raised, which ought to be scary in itself, has raised $348 million in campaign donations when adjusted for inflation, a sum greater than the cost to build the new Longhorn basketball arena at the University of Texas at Austin. The Texas Tribune reviewed 25 years of campaign finance records, covering the entirety of Abbott's political career. The Tribune also examined every political appointment he's made while governor. Texas is one of 11 states without contribution limits, enabling Abbott to raise enormous sums from some of the nation's richest families and individuals. His donors enjoy access to the governor, appointments to boards and commissions, including influential regulatory bodies, and even a COVID-19 task force that set guidelines for reopening businesses, and a chance to bend the ear of a politician who may harbor ambitions for bigger things. At its worst, critics say, Abbott's fundraising prowess can give the appearance of a patronage system. That was the case when Kelsey Warren, co-founder of a pipeline company that made $2.4 billion off the deadly winter storm last year, was accused of giving $1 million to thank Abbott for going easy on the oil and gas industry in 2021 as the legislature attempted to improve the reliability of the state's power grid. Warren, who did not respond to a request for comment, was one of the oil industry players who gave a total of $4.6 million to the governor after that session concluded. Abbott's campaign declined requests for an interview for this story and did not respond to a list of emailed questions, instead issuing a statement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That wasn't the statement. That's my excerpt, basically. So, again, another Tribune deep dive investigative piece that's worth reading or at least seriously skimming. When this stuff is open to the light of day, it's ethically appalling. It's not just seeing the sausage being made. It's seeing the sausage being made corruptly, which is already like a whole other level of sausage. It's another example of politicians being the highest return on investment that money can buy, which is why it should be much harder and less legal to buy them, Andrew.
I think it should be impossible and illegal, personally. Regulating political appointments of big donors is not enough. It needs to be outlawed. Same with accepting model legislation from individuals or companies that gave over the individual FEC limit on contributions to a politician's campaign, which, for context, this year is $2,900, or from organizations that have financial ties to said individuals or companies.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community media. We now air on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and a bonus round Thursday at 6 p.m. At Think Wing Radio, we scour the news for stuff you may not know, and we need your support to keep being able to do that. Please donate to KPFT. Call 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. Or go online to kpft.org and make your pledge of support to keep commercial-free community radio on the air. Each time you turn on the radio, you can hear your dollars at work. When you donate to KPFT, your dollars pay for transmitter and equipment costs. Progressive talk shows like Think Wing Radio, Politics Done Right, and other locally generated political talk shows. KPFT's online streaming and maintaining an extremely wide variety of music programs of many different genres. It's really, I think, one of the key pieces of what makes many people love KPFT. So KPFT depends on your financial support to keep bringing you Think Wing Radio and all this other type of stuff. Contribute whatever you can. Please pick the show you're supporting. No amount is too large or too small, and it's tax deductible. Call 713-526-5738, again, 713-526-5738, or give online at kpft.org. You'll be glad you did. Okay, next story. Beto O'Rourke, this is from, again, the Texas Tribune. Beto O'Rourke catches Governor Greg Abbott in cash on hand as race hits home stretch. Beto O'Rourke officially caught up to Greg Abbott in fundraising for the governor's race this last month, erasing Abbott's once formidable cash-on-hand advantage. New campaign finance reports show O'Rourke ended the latest reporting period of July 1 through September 29 With $16.47 million in cash, Abbott had $16.35 million in cash, so about $100,000 difference. Abbott spent far more than O'Rourke during the period, $53 million to $32 million, and the governor's campaign said his expenses included $30 million in pre-purchased advertising time through Election Day. Still, the development shows O'Rourke is by far the biggest financial threat Abbott has ever faced. O'Rourke outraised Abbott by a decisive margin during the prior reporting period and narrowly outraised him again during the latest reporting period. The new filings with the Texas Ethics Commission, a state agency, came as polls continue to give Abbott a lead in the mid-single digits. Abbott himself suggested Wednesday he saw a stable race unfolding, or rather to say a stable race, not a horse race, the opposite of a horse race, actually. A stable race unfolding, telling reporters in Dallas that the polls have, quote, been flatlined for months now. A Marist poll released Wednesday gave about a 4 percentage point lead to Abbott, though that was among registered voters. Likely voters are more commonly surveyed in the final weeks of an election. The Marist poll did survey voters who said they will definitely vote, and Abbott led among them by 8 points. But the fundraising reports show O'Rourke cannot be counted out yet. He had over 5 times more contributions than Abbott had over the summer period, roughly $472,000 to $86,000. The ratio was similar in the previous period. Both men received 6- and 7-figure checks, but Abbott had far more of them as he leaned heavily on high-dollar donors over the summer. Abbott's average contribution size increased $289 from $221 in the previous period. O'Rourke's average contribution size during the most recent period, $53 per donor, was virtually unchanged. Abbott's top donors at $1 million each were California real estate developer Ed Roskey Jr. and Miriam Adelson, the wife of the late casino mogul and GOP mega donor Sheldon Adelson. O'Rourke's number one donor was cryptocurrency billionaire Sam Bankman-Fried, who gave $1 million. O'Rourke also got $500,000 from George Soros, the New York-based Democratic mega donor who cut a $1 million check to O'Rourke during the previous period. O'Rourke continued to get more money from outside Texas. On the latest report, 41% of the money he raised was from out of state compared to Abbott's 19%, as was 51.8% of Abbott's contributions of Beto's contributions compared to Abbott's 50.7%. So again, a whole lot of this article that I've left out because I had to keep the excerpt reasonable. As usual, I've linked in my blog post to any articles I cite, so you can check me and see if you feel I've excerpted and discussed fairly. As one might guess from the in-state and out-of-state money involved, this is seen as a high-stakes race. It's been so long since a Democrat has held statewide office in Texas that I don't think it's happened in Andrew's lifetime. Not since 1994. And it's a fair election without unreasonable barriers in voting, or rather in a fair election without unreasonable barriers to voting. It's becoming more likely. It's definitely – I'm sorry. I was about to read Andrew's part. Andrew, read your part.
And that's a quick reminder that I type out most of my comments ahead of time. So if you and they're posted on the blog at thinkwingradio.com. So if I say something and you didn't quite catch it, head over there and take a read. Yeah, it's definitely not happened in my lifetime, a Democrat being elected to statewide office. The earliest governor I can remember is Rick Perry, and a fair election would give a better chance to challengers, but this isn't going to be a fair election, not with SB1 in place. As for O'Rourke's coffers, I don't really find it comforting that he outraised Abbott while accepting big donations, even if his average contribution was still under $100. If O'Rourke wins, I would be disappointed but not surprised to find that crypto guy appointed to something.
Yeah, I could foresee that possibility. Hopefully something relatively harmless, but, you know.
Yeah, you'd hope, but who knows?
Relatively harmless, but statusy.
Hmm.
Also, I do have a reference there to Texas Democrats shut out of statewide office longer than Democrats in other states. So that's there if you want to read it. From the New York Times. Now, this is from September 8th, but I felt that it's pretty much a timeless story.
And because a big issue around elections is misinformation. So this fits.
Yes, exactly. When teens find misinformation, these teachers are ready. Media literacy efforts are intensifying, targeting students as they approach voting age. But some educators struggle to, quote, push through that apathy. Between lessons about the Revolutionary War and the functions of Congress, juniors in several, they actually learn that stuff still, phased. Juniors in several history and U.S. government classes at Palmer High School in Colorado Springs are taught to defend themselves against disinformation. The students, many of them on the cusp of voting age, spend up to 2 weeks each fall exploring how falsehoods, prejudices, and opinions can lurk in the many places they get information. They learn to trace the origins of documents to validate a website by leaving it to consult other sources and to train a critical eye on the claims made by TikTok influencers on the YouTube videos. Ironically, we'll be quoting one of them soon, but, you know, we've listened to that carefully. With students and adults alike, it's just easy to look at stuff on social media and take it as it is and not question it, said Paul Blakesley, who has taught students about media and information literacy for several years at the high school. He went on, it can be difficult to push through that apathy, but it's well worth trying. Children and teenagers are not the only ones susceptible to misinformation. Several studies suggest that older adults are more likely to struggle to recognize fake news and are more likely to share it. But with young people spending more time online, where misleading and false narratives swirl around the upcoming midterm elections, the COVID-19 pandemic, and other topics, educators are increasingly trying to offer protection against, in a form of inoculation, as it happens. Using techniques updated for the digital age, they are teaching students that teaching students that virality does not confer legitimacy, that content can be fabricated or manipulated, and that a .org domain does not make a website trustworthy. Hopefully I'll have a chance to mention a little story I have about that. At Palmer High School, Mr. Blakesley tries to demonstrate how to distinguish between good information and bad. Who are the sources? What is their perspective? What is appropriate? When is it appropriate to turn to Wikipedia? Several educational groups representing more than 350,000 teachers in math, social studies, and other disciplines created an alliance to better understand or better support those trying to teach media literacy. One of the founding groups, the National Association of Media Literacy Education, said its own membership had more than doubled in the past 5 years. Federal and state legislators have tried to, in recent years, to support media literacy in public schools. Five states, including Colorado, passed language since early 2020, that required education departments to take steps, such as providing literacy resources and revising learning standards, according to the nonprofit Media Literacy Now. Many of the existing laws amount to legislative endorsements of the need for literacy education rather than actual mandates. Only one state, Illinois, requires that high school students be taught how to gain access to and analyze media messages. Without an explicit mandate from lawmakers, though, some schools, many of which face staff shortages and political fights over classroom subjects, struggle to integrate media literacy into their curriculum. And those that do manage to do so often teach it using outdated checklists delivered in short bursts rather than as an integrated part of core subjects. But media and information literacy advocates said the difficulties were outweighed by the dangers if young students fail to recognize rhetorical red flags and fall prey to confirmation bias online, where they could unwittingly feed rumors to contribute to polarization. Before Andrew takes his piece, I just want to mention two very brief stories. Once I was judging a debate for a junior high school, and one of the students mentioned a piece of information and confidently said, and this comes from suchandsuch.org.
Mm.
And I had to... During the review of that, I had to say, just because a URL ends in .org, originally that meant like informational, educational, maybe apolitical. And now it's just, hey, it's a website that's available with the name I want. If I have to get it with a .org, I will. And you can no longer look at a .org site and assume it's a nonprofit or assume it's sort of educational.
Or that it's a trustworthy source.
Well, that's what you have to appraise, but you can't appraise it based simply on the fact that it's a .org. It has to be appraised just like any other veracity, just like veracity on any other website needs to be appraised. Andrew?
Yes, I thought you had another story. You said you had two.
Oh, actually, I did. Yeah, my little girl, when she was like three, and she would watch the early morning TV shows, and I was fascinated to find that she thought of commercials as kind of like news for children.
Huh.
So when she was watching a commercial, like for a new doll or a new play set or something like that, she saw that as news for her.
Huh.
And she didn't understand that it was a sales presentation.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really interesting insight to see in action.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if kids that young see commercials as news, then there's probably a parallel to how older kids see misinformation and disinformation thrown at them from media that they figure, well, it's on the internet. It must be true.
Hmm.
I mean, you get to a point where you realize that's not the case, but you also get to a point where you realize that advertisements for toys aren't news.
Yes. Yeah, that reminds me of they've changed their name, but there used to be an organization. There is an organization that used to be called the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood or an Advertising-Free Childhood or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I just learned of them recently, but I thought it was a very interesting concept, essentially, you know, trying to ban advertising on children's networks and this sort of thing. I don't know the full extent of their, you know, platform and proposals. So I'm sure that there's some other consideration for, you know, media conglomerate profits. But yeah, I think it's an interesting idea and one that should be considered. As I was planning to say this whole time, my last media literacy module was a few years ago now, back when I was still in college, but I mostly remember it focusing on sorting sources into trustworthy versus untrustworthy, which is important, absolutely. But equally important to me is being able to ask who benefits. Who benefits from these assertions? How do they benefit? What might they be able to do or say to get people to believe the assertion? It's a useful set of questions because it doesn't assume that there's credible sources and non-credible sources and never the twain shall meet, and it doesn't try to neatly sort a source into one box or the other. The questions are just as valid and just as insightful when asked of an objectively true source as they are when asked of an untrue one. I got a little bit tongue-tied there. They reveal
hey,
the
that
possibility.
Never happens to me.
They reveal the possibility of bias, conscious and unconscious. Knowing where bias can be present can help you figure out who is telling the truth, but it can also help you find bits of untruth in otherwise truthful sources as well. I hope media literacy is also taking mixed truth into account.
I substantially agree with what Andrew has said on this point. However, I do think that sources still matter.
Hmm.
I think there's a point to be made for the evaluation of what is there to be gained by reporting a certain thing a certain way and who is possibly in a position to gain from it. I mean, I think all of those analyses have value anytime you want to look critically at a piece of information, especially since even the most unbiased journalists are human beings and it's hard for them to be entirely unbiased.
Yeah.
Even after they go through an editor, you've got the editor's biases working. So I think that the veracity, the reliability of sources still matter.
Mm-hmm.
But sources that seem consistently accurate with the facts, and you learn this by cross-checking, should be valued over simply a cost-benefit analysis of the benefit or lack thereof to the writer or the provider of the information.
I would absolutely agree that, yeah, a track record is just as important as, you know, the analysis of where the biases can be. I wouldn't put one over the other. I think that's where we differ. But I would absolutely, yeah, my intention was not to discount the idea of, you know, track records and that sort of thing.
Well, even, you know, I cite the New York Times, I cite the New York Post, the Guardian, I'm sorry, the Washington Post, occasionally Post, the Guardian, and those are sources that I consider to be pretty good, but they also have opinion pieces, which they mostly clearly mark as opinion pieces or op-ed pieces.
Mm.
And especially when you read those, you really don't know what, unless you follow that particular columnist, you really don't know what you're in for. And that's a place where Andrew's criteria begin to make a big difference. Does this person have a particular axe to grind in terms of being pro-socialist or pro-capitalist or really pro-capitalist or anti-labor? There is a lot of merit to looking at a sort of a transactional feature within an opinion column. So I think that there's room for a lot of those different ways of critiquing, evaluating, deciding what to trust when you read things.
Yeah.
Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and a bonus Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live on kpft.org. You can find Google Podcasts at the Android store or the iPhone store, and you can download this show with Google Podcasts. You can also visit archive.kpft.org and listen to earlier versions of this and almost 100 other shows that are on KPFT. We here heavily excerpt every story on the show, which is why we include links to full articles on show posts and more at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to catch what's new at the station. They've been updating that page. It's not just the same old static page. Catch up with your favorite shows on the archive. Help keep KPFT keep the lights on. And you can do that by clicking on the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at, ready, 713-526-5738. That's 713-526, as some people like it, KPFT. Personally, I don't care for it, but it's 5738. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio at msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Thinkwing Radio with Mike Honig. I'm on Twitter at Thinkwing Radio. There's a certain repetition here. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
You know, we need a jingle for that.
A jingle for what exactly?
For the promo piece.
For the promo piece.
Yeah, I mean, jingles really stick in your head. We need a jingle. We have musicians. Sandy, we need a jingle.
A ThinkWing jingle or a KPFT jingle?
Well, I think we should start with the KPFT donate jingle.
Okay, okay.
They can use it as a bumper. They can build it into shows. They can have hosts sing it in good fun. Mm. Not necessarily in good musical fun.
Not necessarily good in fun. Good taste, yeah, but in good fun.
Not necessarily in good taste. Good fun. Okay, so our next story is something that I've been thinking about for a while because it's kind of in the news recently these days. And it's actually a Guardian article from June 16, 2022. I've only taken a piece of it out. You can, of course, go to the link with the whole article. I felt it was worth discussing, why do central banks want to raise interest rates? What's the benefit? What's the point? How does it affect inflation? How does it affect you? How does it affect business? How does it affect trade? It affects all those things. So I thought, you know, maybe it's worth discussing it a little. So let's talk about central bank interest rates and why you should care. First, when the cost of a loan goes up, well, the cost of a loan goes up. But the price of fuel and other imports can go down. Now, the United States is actually in a sort of privileged position here because at least to this point in time, oil is priced in U.S. dollars. So when the price of oil goes up in U.S. dollars, it goes up for everybody. When the value of the dollar goes up, effectively, the price of oil goes down for the U.S. dollar. It goes up for everybody else. The same thing is true for a lot of imports. When the U.S. dollar goes up in value, and here's the mechanism. If treasury bonds and bank accounts are charging more interest than other trustworthy central or large banks in other places around the world, that draws money to the United States for the higher yields. There's a lot of money that sloshes around countries. Sometimes it's not even the interest rate that draws money to the U.S. dollar. It's just because the United States may be the only country, major country in the world, that in its entire history has never defaulted on a debt. Something, by the way, which the Republicans have been trying to change. So that's one reason why interest rates go up is basically, in this particular case, it reduces inflation by reducing the cost of imported goods. Now, higher central bank rates in the U.S. do help fight inflation that way. In a typical basket of goods and services, prices rise when either supply is constrained or demand outstrips supply. Higher rates make borrowing more expensive and encourage saving. So now we're not talking about people that are living so hand to mouth that the decision of spending versus saving is not an option for them. But if you have a chance to defer a purchase, that puts less pressure on prices, at least, you know, in an ideal economic system. Higher rates make borrowing more expensive and encourage saving. We're going to actually touch on that with an audio piece we're going to be listening to in a little bit. But while it doesn't, and I'm going to sort of do a little spoiler here, and I hope it doesn't ruin it for great piece. But, you know, while higher interest rates don't necessarily make food less expensive and don't necessarily make, what was the other category that was drugs less expensive? But what it does is large purchases that typically require loans, whether it's cars or houses, vacations, or whatever the many things are that people will sometimes buy with credit, fewer of those things are bought. So there's less competition on a supply and demand basis in the classic theory. When there's less demand, it drives prices down. This is also true of business investment. So if a company is thinking of upgrading its equipment, it will borrow less money in order, because the money is more expensive, it'll wait for the interest rates to go down, for the cost of money to go down. It will defer its infrastructure improvement. And while that might leave the company running as a less efficient entity for a while, it does put less pressure on the suppliers who would have upgraded that equipment, on the tool and die makers, on the metal refiners, on the software engineers, et cetera, et cetera. So all of this is basically to drive down demand. Now, the next section is, how does it affect you? This is from the Guardian article. When the central bank raises interest rates, high street lenders, which is what they call them in Britain, pass them on to the consumer and commercial borrowers and savers. And while they're typically slower to raise interest rates on deposits, yeah, it's like gasoline prices go up way faster than they go down. So I'm familiar with that theory. Mortgage costs can rise quite quickly. Those on standard variable rates, which track the bank's base rate, are the first to see the difference. Yeah, don't buy a house with a variable. Just don't. It's like the only thing worse than that is buying a reverse. Just don't. However, most homeowners have fixed rate mortgages. This means you won't see higher costs until you come to the end of your term. This is one of the reasons central banks say it can take time for higher rates to counter inflation. Renters are also likely to come under pressure as buy-to-let landlords pass on higher borrowing costs to their tenants. Basically, carrying costs get higher, so they raise rents. That's aside from just the excuse to raise rents based on supply and demand. When the bank raised interest rates, this would be the exchequer, I guess. When the bank raised interest rates 0.25% to 1%, analysts at Hargreaves Lansdown estimated it would push mortgage rates up over £40 per month. Against a backdrop of rising interest rates, the Office of the Budget Responsibility estimates household debt services rising from £55 billion to £85 billion over the next 2 years. Now, Andrew, I think you had some comments to make.
I do. I mean, I think that it's important to recognize that higher interest on loans doesn't just magically make prices go down. I actually saw a good TikTok from More Perfect Union explaining this. It's about the financial structure here in the U.S., but I think a lot of its observations apply in other nations and on the global scale as well. We'll play it for you now.
And just for the record, I think it's brilliant.
They're finally doing something about inflation. This is great news.
Well, what they're set to do is likely to make this worse. The Fed's plan is going to increase the amount of people who are unemployed.
Why would they do that?
Well, the Fed just issued its largest interest rate hike since 1994. Their working theory is that if they increase interest rates, it'll be more expensive to borrow money. So less people will start businesses and invest in businesses. That means there will be less jobs. And when there's less jobs, there's more competition in the labor market. People will take jobs for lower wages. Wages will go down. People will have less money. There will be less spending into the economy and demand will go down and then prices will go down.
Does that always work?
The solution's got to be relevant to the problem. Economists are criticizing the Fed for taking this approach because the problem is prices are high. We need a solution that will bring them back down. And this approach won't do that.
So then why does the Fed think it will work?
They don't.
What?
They don't. Jerome Powell admitted that on the floor of Congress.
Chair Powell, will gas prices go down as a result of your interest rate increase?
I would not think so, no.
Okay. Chair Powell, will the Fed's interest rate increases bring food prices down for families?
No, I wouldn't say so, no.
So then how do we fix inflation? So keep in mind here, inflation is a measure of price changes over time. So to get these prices back down, we've got to know why they were set higher. Do we know what caused the price increases? Listen, there's a lot going on. The COVID pandemic, supply chain breakdowns, shortages from sanctions and war, all of those things can add to the cost of getting goods and services to market. But corporations are seeing record profits, which means that they set prices higher than to just account for the additional production and transportation costs. They set prices higher to make money.
You know how CEOs are on Wall Street. They live quarter by quarter. If they're off by a penny in earnings, Wall Street is not forgiven. So what are the CEOs doing? They're raising prices. I see food prices going up. Promotions are down to zero. Why give away something when you don't have to give it away and you make more margin?
CEOs are admitting to doing this.
Why give away something when you don't have to give it away and you make more margin?
So people are struggling to get by and pay their bills, and corporations just set higher prices because they can to make more money? And the Fed's response is to make more people out of a job? How is any of this legal? Exactly. Okay, cowboy. Thanks, I guess.
Those voices in order were a representative of More Perfect Union, then Senator Elizabeth Warren, then Jerome Powell, chair of the Federal Reserve, and finally John Katsimatidis, CEO of the Red Apple Group. So corporations are milking consumers for all they're worth and using tumultuous world events as an excuse, driving prices higher, and the Fed's response will cause human suffering and won't even bring prices down because demand isn't the problem, prices are. So what should the government do instead? I say that the solution to high prices is not to decrease consumer power, it's to decrease business power by setting price controls. If they're distributed evenly along supply chains, the lower materials costs will compensate for the lower profit per item at the retail end. And don't forget, just like during a sale, when prices are lower, people buy more, and businesses profit more overall per consumer. I think this is the kind of economic policy that the public should be pushing for. Workers should also be unionizing and taking direct action to resist layoffs so that companies can't cut jobs so easily when interest rates go up. If you want to organize but you need a place to start, I personally suggest the Industrial Workers of the World. Even if you don't unionize with them, they have a great organizer training program that anyone can take for a small fee. Mike?
Yeah, there's always the issue of supply and demand driving prices, and I think that Andrew doesn't give enough emphasis to the legitimacy of that aspect. But that gets us into the issue of what is a fair profit versus what is price gouging. And I think that's a legitimate discussion here. As far as unions go, I've said before that I believe in the socio-political triad of labor, business, government. When one of those legs of that triad is too weak, you get societal and economic imbalances. And with the labor leg the way it is, we are far beyond that point, and it needs a drastic correction.
I'll agree with you on that, definitely.
Okay, I think that's all we have time for today. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's Community Media, KPFT 90.1 HD2. My co-host and indispensable editor and good-humored fellow is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed the show, found it interesting, and we'll look forward to having you join us again next week. You all take care.
See you later.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Centralia, Washington, long relied on jobs from a coal mine and a coal-fired power plant. But the mine closed in 2006, and the power plant is set to be retired in 3 years. So Centralia's been planning for a future without coal. As part of negotiations about the shutdown, the company that owns the power plant agreed to invest $55 million to help Centralia diversify its economy. Much of that money is going toward energy efficiency projects.
You're talking about things like heating, ventilating, and air conditioning, and door and window replacement, and insulation. Those are the kinds of things done by local companies, local contractors, and they in turn hire local employees.
Sean O'Leary of the Ohio River Valley Institute has been studying Centralia's approach. He says investing in the energy efficiency industry is beneficial because the work is labor-intensive, so much of the money is spent on workers' wages. And it also helps residents save on utility bills, so they have more disposable income to spend in the community.
And so you simply have a richer environment for companies to do business.
So he says there are many benefits to investing in energy efficiency as part of preparing for a post-coal future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
I love it. I'd like to encourage you to support my hometown radio station, KPFT, in Houston. It's as easy as calling 713-526-5738 or donating online at kpft.org. Please, if you can, give to KPFT.